Encyclical letter Magnifica Humanitas of Pope Leo XIV on safeguarding the human person in the time of artificial intelligence.
Chapter 3, Technology and Dominance, the Grandeur of Humanity in Light of the Promises of AI. Paragraph 90. Having recalled the principles that shine a light on social doctrine, I would now like to focus on certain challenges that profoundly shape our way of living today. The biblical image accompanying these reflections is that of a building project. On the one hand, there is the Tower of Babel, where collective effort follows a plan that dominates and ultimately dehumanizes. On the other hand, there are the ruins of Jerusalem, which under Nehemiah's direction are rebuilt piece by piece as a project of shared responsibility. We are called to reflect on the great construction sites of our era and ask, what are we building? As technological development rapidly transforms languages and relationships, institutions and forms of power, we believers must and can choose which projects to work on and in what manner, so as to safeguard and value the grandeur of humanity that has been given to us as a gift. This is a choice not only for our future, but also for our present, since artificial intelligence and other emerging technologies are already part of our daily lives. Paragraph 91. I am convinced that the concrete way of living out social relationships in the light of the gospel is not established once and for all, but remains a task entrusted from generation to generation to the Christian community. Under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, the Church allows herself to be enlightened by God's Word, reads the signs of the times, and creatively seeks new ways for relationships between peoples and nations to become ever more conformed to the demands of the kingdom of God. For this reason, I encourage all members of the Church not to be afraid of the present challenges, but to listen to one another and firmly embrace their responsibilities in building a more humane and fraternal society. The technocratic paradigm and digital power. Paragraph 92. In his encyclical Laudato Si, Pope Francis denounced the growing dominance of a technocratic paradigm in our globalized world, the tendency to let the logic of efficiency, control, and profit alone shape personal, social, and economic decisions. This makes it clear that technology is not simply a tool. When it becomes the standard by which everything is judged, it begins to dictate what matters and what can be discarded, reducing creation to an object of exploitation and human beings to mere cogs in a system driven toward ever greater efficiency. Paragraph 93. This paradigm has spread rapidly in recent years, fueled in part by the expansion of artificial intelligence, cognitive science, nanotechnology, robotics, and biotechnology. In themselves, these innovations can greatly serve integral human development and the care of our common home. Yet, precisely because of their power, they can also hasten the expansion of the technocratic paradigm and therefore require a new spiritual, ethical, and political framework. More power does not necessarily imply something better. In this respect, the words of Romano Guardini remain relevant. Contemporary man has not been trained to use power well. Paragraph 94. The danger of humanity becoming a victim of its own achievements was already clearly recognized by St. Paul VI, who warned that the most extraordinary scientific progress, the most astounding technical feats, and the most amazing economic growth, unless accompanied by authentic moral and social progress, will, in the long run, go against man. For this reason, technological progress, valuable in itself, requires careful discernment of the anthropological vision that guides it and the ends it pursues. If technological development advances without a corresponding ethical and social progress, the result can be an increase in means without a growth in humanity, having more without being more. In such a scenario, there's a risk that individuals will be evaluated principally according to the outcomes they produce. Paragraph 95. Here we must recognize another crucial aspect, which I have noted earlier. in many cases within the digital context, control over platforms, infrastructure, data, and computing power does not rest with states, but with major economic and technological actors. These entities effectively set the conditions for access, determine the rules of visibility, and shape the very possibilities for participation. When such power is concentrated in the hands of a few, it tends to become opaque and evade public oversight, increasing the risk of distorted forms of development that give rise to new dependencies, exclusions, manipulations, and inequalities. Paragraph 96. Faced with this concentration of power in the digital world, the criteria for judgment and discernment in this new situation are the noble principles of social doctrine, the inalienable dignity of the human person, the common good, the universal destination of goods, subsidiarity, solidarity, and social justice. They demand that we assess whether the power of digital infrastructures and algorithms truly fosters participation and responsibility, protects the vulnerable, ensures fair access to opportunities, and remains directed toward the common good of all. On this basis, we can now examine more closely what artificial intelligence is, the possibilities it opens up, and the risks it entails. Artificial Intelligence. Paragraph 97. It is not my intention here to offer a comprehensive treatment of artificial intelligence, nor to give an overview of the extensive relevant literature, since authoritative contributions already exist, including within the ecclesial context. I limit myself to recalling a few essential elements for a moral and social discernment that safeguards the primacy of the human person, in order to ensure that it will always be human intelligence, with its conscience and freedom, that guides technical innovations and responsibly determines their use and limits. Paragraph 98. It's appropriate to preface this discussion with two considerations. First, any statement regarding AI risks becoming quickly outdated, given the remarkable pace at which these systems are developing. Second, all of us, including those who design them, possess only a limited understanding of their actual functioning. Indeed, current AI systems are more cultivated than built, for developers do not directly design every detail, but instead create a framework within which the intelligence grows. As a result, fundamental scientific aspects, such as the internal representations and computational processes of these systems, remain at present unknown. Thus, there emerges an urgent need for a twofold commitment. On the one hand, a deepening of scientific research. On the other, the exercise of moral and spiritual discernment. Paragraph 99. It's not possible to provide a single comprehensive definition of AI. What can be stated, however, is that we must avoid the misconception of equating this type of intelligence with that of human beings. These systems merely imitate certain functions of human intelligence. In doing so, they often surpass human intelligence in speed and computational capacity, offering tangible benefits across many fields. Yet this power remains entirely tied to data processing. So-called artificial intelligences do not undergo experiences, do not possess a body, do not feel joy or pain, do not mature through relationships, and do not know from within what love, work, friendship, or responsibility mean. Nor do they have a moral conscience, since they do not judge good and evil, grasp the ultimate meaning of situations, or bear responsibility for consequences. They may imitate language, behavior, and analytical skills, or even simulate empathy and understanding, but they do not understand what they produce, for they lack the affective, relational, and spiritual perspective through which human beings grow in wisdom. Even when these tools are described as capable of learning, their way of doing so is different from that of a human person. It is not the experience of those who allow themselves to be shaped by life and grow over time through choices, mistakes, forgiveness, and fidelity. Rather, it's a form of statistical adaptation based on data and feedback, which can be very effective, but does not imply inner growth. A valuable tool that requires vigilance. Paragraph 100. In the light of what's been said, we can better understand why AI can be a valuable tool and at the same time why it calls for a measured and vigilant approach. In recent years, its private use has expanded significantly, prompting growing reflection on both the opportunities it offers and the risks tied to its rapid spread. In personal use, three aspects in particular deserve careful consideration: the ease with which results are obtained, the impression of objectivity and the simulation of human communication, the speed and simplicity with which information, complex analysis, media content, and practical assistance can be accessed undoubtedly makes life easier. Yet, they can also encourage excessive reliance and the search for ready-made answers, and weaken personal creativity and judgment. The apparent objectivity of the responses and suggestions these systems provide can lead us to overlook the fact that they reflect the cultural assumptions of those who designed and trained them, with all their strengths and limitations. The artificial imitation of positive human communication, words of advice, empathy, friendship, and even love can be engaging and at times genuinely helpful. However, for less discerning users, it can be misleading, creating the illusion of a relationship with a real personal subject. When words are simulated, they do not build genuine relationships, but only their appearance. The artificial imitation of care and support can become particularly risky when it enters contexts where real relationships and emotional bonds are lacking. Here, the danger is not so much that a person may believe they are communicating with another person, but rather that they may gradually lose the very desire to form genuine human connections. Paragraph 101. Broadening our perspective to the use of AI in society, we see that it's now embedded in decision-making processes across many sectors and at multiple levels, in communication, management, and control. The gains in efficiency and the potential to improve certain services are clear, yet rapidly and uncritically adopting them exposes us to a range of risks, including the tendency to overlook the environmental impact. Current AI systems require enormous amounts of energy and water, significantly influencing carbon dioxide emissions, and place heavy demands on natural resources. As their complexity increases, especially in the case of large language models, the need for computing power and storage capacity grows too, which requires an extensive network of machines, cables, data centers, and energy-intensive infrastructure. For this reason, it's essential to develop more sustainable technological solutions that reduce environmental impact and help protect our common home. Responsibility, transparency, and the governance of AI. Paragraph 102. The use of AI is never a purely technical matter. When it enters processes that affect people's lives, it touches on rights, opportunities, status, and freedom. Important and sensitive decisions concerning employment, credit, access to public services, or even a person's reputation risk being fully delegated to automated systems that do not know compassion, mercy, forgiveness, and, above all, the hope that people are able to change and can therefore give rise to new forms of exclusion. There are clearly harmful uses, such as the manipulation of information or violations of privacy. Yet there's also a subtler change, for when AI systems present themselves as neutral and objective, they end up reflecting and reinforcing the stereotypes or ideological bias of their designers and developers. Paragraph 103. Indeed, entrusting an algorithm in practice with the power to select who is worthy or not, without anyone bearing responsibility for that judgment, is to hand over the task of redefining the boundaries of human possibilities. In this process, political responsibility is also lost, not just empathy toward those excluded, which can, after all, be simulated. The exclusion of the vulnerable becomes cloaked in a veneer of neutrality and objectivity, against which it becomes difficult to raise objections. In this way, injustice goes unnoticed, and compassion, mercy, and forgiveness, understood not as mere appearances but as real political actions, gradually disappear from view. Paragraph 104. From this follows a simple but compelling consequence. We cannot consider AI to be morally neutral. In reality, every technical tool embodies choices and priorities through what it measures, ignores and optimizes, and how it classifies people and situations. If a system is designed or used in a way that treats some lives as less worthy or excludes them without the possibility of appeal, then it is not merely a tool to be used well, since it has already introduced criteria that contradict the inalienable dignity of the human person. For this reason, ethical discernment cannot be limited to asking whether we are using a system for good or bad purposes. It must also examine how that system is designed and what vision of the human person and society is embedded in the data and models that guide it. Paragraph 105. For AI to respect human dignity and truly serve the common good, responsibility must be clearly defined at every stage, from those who design and develop these systems to those who use them and rely on them for concrete decisions. In many cases, however, the internal processes leading to a result remain opaque, making it harder to assign responsibility and correct errors. This is where accountability becomes crucial, the possibility of identifying who must account for decisions, justify them, monitor them, and, when necessary, challenge them and remedy any harm caused. Paragraph 106. Calling for prudence, rigorous evaluation, and even at times a slower pace in adopting AI does not mean opposing progress. Instead, it's an exercise of responsible care for the human family. This need is all the more urgent given the frequent imbalance between the speed of technological growth and the slower development of awareness, norms, safeguards, and institutions capable of governing its effects. It's not enough to invoke ethics in the abstract. Robust legal frameworks, independent oversight, informed users, and a political system that does not abdicate its responsibility are required. Otherwise, change will be governed only by technocratic thinking and presented as necessary and inevitable, ultimately imposing rules shaped by those who control data, infrastructure, and computing power. Paragraph 107. We cannot be satisfied with merely calling for the moralization of machines, the so-called alignment of AI with human values, without also having the courage to insist on a further condition: the possibility of openly discussing the ethical frameworks involved and subjecting them to shared standards of social justice. Otherwise, those who control AI will impose their own moral vision, which will become the invisible infrastructure of these systems. A more moral AI is not enough if that morality is determined by few. What is needed is a more active political involvement that is capable of slowing things down when everything is accelerating, and of protecting the opportunities for communities still to be able to participate and ask questions. Paragraph 108. In fact, as with every major technological shift, AI tends to amplify the power of those who already possess economic resources, expertise, and access to data. In light of the common good and the universal destination of goods, this raises serious concerns, since small but highly influential groups can shape information and consumption patterns, influence democratic processes, and steer economic dynamics to their own advantage, undermining social justice and solidarity among peoples. For this reason, it's essential that the use of AI, especially when it touches on public goods and fundamental rights, be guided by clear criteria and effective oversight grounded in participation and subsidiarity. Communities and intermediary organizations must not be reduced to passive recipients of decisions made elsewhere. They must also be able to contribute to discernment and oversight. Moreover, ownership of data cannot be left solely in private hands, but must be appropriately regulated. Data is the product of many contributors and should not be treated as something to be sold off or entrusted to a select few. It's necessary to think creatively in order to manage data as a common or shared good, in a spirit of participation, as St. John Paul II already suggested regarding collective goods. Paragraph 109. The principles of social doctrine offer a framework for understanding this new reality. In a world where data, computational resources, and regulatory influence remain in the hands of a few, to speak of the common good means exposing these new form of epistemic, economic, and political asymmetry and naming the new monopolies of AI. To speak of the universal destination of goods means finding ways of ensuring universal access to both technologies and the education needed to use them. To speak of subsidiarity calls for protecting the ability of communities to make choices and corrections, rather than confining their role to mere oversight after the standards have been set elsewhere. To speak of solidarity obliges us to recognize the hidden, often exploited workers who sustain algorithmic systems. To speak of justice requires questioning the global distribution of power that decides who, in fact, can train these models and who is merely subjected to them. Likewise, it means acknowledging that social justice is not only to be safeguarded after technologies are deployed, but a condition that must shape their very design from the outset. Paragraph 110. Finally, I would like to employ the expression to disarm, which is close to my heart. Disarming AI means freeing it from the mentality of armed competition, which today is not limited simply to the military context, but is also an economic and cognitive phenomenon. This entails a race for ever more powerful algorithms and larger datasets, driven by the desire to secure geopolitical or commercial dominance. To disarm means discrediting the assumption that technical power automatically confers the right to govern. To disarm does not mean rejecting technology, but preventing it from dominating humanity. It means freeing technology from monopolistic control and opening it to discussion and debate, therefore making it human-friendly and restoring it to the plurality of human cultures and the ways of life. Our task today is not only ethical or technical. It's ecological in the deepest sense, for it concerns a new dimension of our common home. AI is already an environment in which we are immersed, as well as a force with which we must engage. For this reason, merely regulating it is insufficient. It must be disarmed, welcoming, and accessible. Paragraph 111. I wish to address a special appeal to those who develop artificial intelligence. In one sense, technological innovation can represent human participation in the divine act of creation. Developers, therefore, bear a particular ethical and spiritual responsibility, for every design choice reflects a vision of humanity. Just as the creator of an artistic or literary work must consider the values it conveys, so developers are called to embed values in their projects with due seriousness, with transparency, responsibility toward affected communities, and careful attention to ensuring that what is being cultivated is a genuine good. What must not be lost? Paragraph 112. Having considered the issues of responsibility and governance of AI, we must now return to our central question. What does it mean to safeguard our humanity? The risk extends beyond the misuse of certain technologies. More gravely, the pervasive technocratic paradigm in which we are immersed, and that is amplified by the digital revolution and AI, threatens to normalize an anti-human vision. In that vision, the fullness of life is equated with having more, reducing weakness, eliminating uncertainty, and exerting total control. When efficiency becomes the ultimate measure of value, human beings are tempted to see themselves as a project to be optimized rather than as persons called to relationship and communion. Paragraph 113. In reality, elevating any single dimension of human existence to an absolute is always a mistake. Indeed, disorder does not arise only from scarcity. Even unchecked growth can give rise to impoverishment. In an ecosystem, balance is disrupted when one species expands at the expense of others. In human life, something similar occurs when one faculty claims to be the measure of everything. Thus, intelligence, when absolutized, overshadows other essential dimensions of life, such as affection, the will, commitment, and relationships. Similarly, technical power, if left unbalanced, does not make us more capable. It makes us more isolated and more vulnerable to being dominated and excluded. This critical point does not oppose intelligence, but serves as a reminder that when intelligence becomes self-referential, its true purpose of serving life and the human person is lost. Paragraph 114. The quality of a civilization is measured not by the power of its means, but by the care it is able to offer, by its ability to recognize the other as a face, not merely as a function. The ability to care for one another is a fundamental dimension of our humanity, one that is learned and mastered through lived experience. Reading stories to a child, offering company to an elderly person, and arranging a home so that it is welcoming are simple gestures often rooted in family life. They can teach us to value care at a societal level and train us to recognize others as persons worthy of attention. Technology can also support this mutual care between people, for example, by providing tools that help us anticipate and organize things without undermining human freedom and judgment. After all, human beings are the subjects of relationships and responsible for their own decisions. Underlying narratives, transhumanism, and posthumanism. Paragraph 115. In an attempt to shed light on the cultural assumptions accompanying the ongoing digital revolution, I would now like to turn our attention to certain currents of thought that interpret progress as surpassing the human condition, and which are often grouped under the labels of transhumanism and posthumanism. These perspectives form the ideological background present in some centers of technological power and occupy the collective imagination in a simplified form, especially in the media and on social networks. They tend to foster enthusiasm for new technologies through a futuristic vision of an enhanced human being or human-machine hybrid. Paragraph 116. Transhumanism and posthumanism encompass a range of currents and sensibilities, making it difficult to define them in a single, unambiguous way. They can be likened to an archipelago of conceptual islands, distinct yet connected by a common sea of assumptions, namely the central role of technology and the aspiration to transcend the limits of the human condition. In general, transhumanism envisions the enhancement of human beings through technologies, such as biomedicine, body engineering, devices, and algorithms, with the aim of increasing performance and capabilities. Posthumanism, especially in its more radical forms, goes further. It challenges anthropocentrism and envisions a hybridization of human beings, machines, and the environment, even acknowledging a threshold where humanity surpasses itself in a new evolutionary stage. Even when such ideas remain largely speculative, they gain relevance by altering the collective imagination and thereby influence social, economic, and political choices. Paragraph 117. From the perspective of the Church's social doctrine, the key issue is not the use of technology as such, but the vision that underlies it. If the human being is treated as something to be perfected or surpassed, it becomes easier to accept that some lives are less useful, less desirable, or less worthy. In the name of progress, necessary sacrifices may begin to be justified, placing the burden on the most vulnerable in pursuit of a supposed optimization of the species. In this regard, the aforementioned warning of St. Paul VI retains great foresight. Indeed, scientific and technological advances, when detached from moral and social progress, end up turning against humanity. For this reason, a clear distinction must be made. It's one thing to integrate technology with a human-centered relational vision. It's quite another to be guided by an outlook that devalues human limits and promises a purely technical form of salvation. The limit, the heart, and the grandeur of the human person. Paragraph 118. Our relationship with life seems to be in crisis today. Everything that appears as a limit, incapacity, illness, old age, suffering, vulnerability, tends to be seen primarily as a defect to be corrected, rather than as a reality through which our humanity matures and opens itself to relationship. And yet we must remember that humanity flourishes not despite limitations, but often through them. The light of faith offers a perspective on reality that helps us recognize what we call the contingency of the things of this world. While it's right to strive to alleviate the suffering that marks human life, it's also wise to acknowledge our fundamental finitude, knowing that religious experience, and in particular Christian faith, propose that we live without oversimplification. This ambivalence between human greatness and limitation, interpreting it in the light of our original and fundamental relationship with God. Paragraph 119. It's precisely within our limitations that the following find a place. Compassion, as well as a sincere concern for the needs of others. A generosity that can emerge even in the midst of darkness and failure. Spiritual experience and the worship of God. We see this at many moments when our limits become tangible, when we face rejection, when we suffer the illness or loss of a loved one, when we encounter our own weakness or failure. Mysteriously, it's precisely in such moments that we can discover a new wisdom, tangibly experience the closeness of others, and encounter the presence of the Lord. Paragraph 120. Even when limitations are experienced as inner suffering, human wisdom teaches us not to deny or suppress it, but to integrate it. To eliminate suffering entirely would mean, in the end, extinguishing love and desire as well. Those who love and desire cannot avoid passing through trial and suffering. And over the years, we carry within us lessons that leave their mark like scars, the memories of a journey shaped by freedom and failure, dreams and disappointments. It's only thanks to the interplay of these elements that the wonders of the soul occur within us, allowing us to sense the richness of our humanity. To renounce this adventure, both tragic and splendid, in the name of a presumed transcendence of all limits, could mean many things, but it would no longer be human. Paragraph 121. The moral corruption of our limitations as created beings, namely the evil that clearly agitates the human heart, ruins society and life, at times reaching extreme forms of inhumanity. Yet even these painful expressions of our limitations leave openings for the good. Even when persons dehumanize themselves and bring about tragedy, a small light continues to shine within humanity, one that can be rekindled with God's grace along paths of conversion and reconciliation. As Viktor Frankl rightly observed, in moments of horror, we have come to know man as he really is. After all, man is that being who invented the gas chambers of Auschwitz. However, he is also that being who entered those gas chambers upright with the Lord's Prayer or the Shema Yisrael on his lips. Paragraph 122. Finitude, when truly accepted, does not diminish us but opens us to recognizing the face of God and others. Indeed, precisely because we experience limits, vulnerability, suffering, and failure, we can recognize the inviolable dignity of every person, both our own and that of others. In this same experience, we remain capable of intuiting a fraternity greater than ourselves and of perceiving injustice as a scandal. Authentic culture and art preserve this spark, resisting the normalization of evil. For this reason, certain works have taken an almost prophetic significance. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony can be seen as a desire for unity, Guernica as a denunciation of dehumanization, Schindler's List as a call not to consign the past to oblivion. Paragraph 123. History does not appear solely as a record of human violence, but also as evidence that humanity is capable of creating institutions that protect our shared life. Over the past two centuries, this can be seen in several emblematic achievements. The founding of the International Committee of the Red Cross in 1863, whose operational neutrality ensures compassionate care for all. The long process that led to the abolition of slavery, which represented not only a legal shift but a transformation of conscience. The establishment of the United Nations in 1945 and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, which articulated a shared language for affirming, at least as a common ideal, the universality of human dignity. And the 1951 Refugee Convention, which recognizes the duty to protect those fleeing persecution and danger. In each of these cases, the desire for good took concrete shape in public contexts, laws, institutions, and practices, capable of limiting the abuse of power and defending the vulnerable. Yet none of these developments emerged without encountering resistance, narrow interests, or cultural inertia. Moral progress almost always unfolds through a long and demanding journey, often marked by setbacks. We need only think of stalled peace processes or the slow implementation of environmental commitments. The very fragility of these achievements highlights how precious the responsibility is of those who initiate and sustain them. Paragraph 124. Certain events make it clear that history can also change when individuals truly take the dignity of everyone seriously. The Civil Rights Movement in the United States of America, closely associated with the testimony of Martin Luther King Jr., or the end of apartheid in South Africa following the release of Nelson Mandela and his decision not to surrender the future to hatred. In different contexts, many courageous and generous women have also stood out, including St. Laura Montoya, St. Teresa of Calcutta, Dorothy Day, Marie Slodowska Curie, Maria Montessori, Elizabeth Elliot, Wangari Maathai, Benazir Bhutto, and countless others from every continent whose commitment has contributed to making history more humane. Paragraph 125. Alongside these public signs, there is a more hidden but decisive story. We see it in religious communities that choose to serve in poor and dangerous places. We also see it in the martyrs of fraternity and justice, such as St. Maximilian Mary Kolbe, St. Oscar Romero, and Blessed Enrique Angelelli, and in those witnesses who embody the hope of the gospel as well as human dignity amidst harsh, often inhumane, conditions, such as Venerable François Xavier Nguyen Van Thuan. Above all, it's visible in the martyrs of everyday life who care for, educate, accompany, and comfort without fanfare, such as parents, nurses, doctors, volunteers, and those who remain alongside an elderly person or an outcast. Their testimony demonstrates that goodness does not advance automatically, but requires the perseverance, memory, and interior conversion necessary to begin anew, even after defeat. Paragraph 126. It's this intertwining of just institutions, credible witnesses, and daily fidelity that sustains hope and provides clear direction for technological progress without allowing the heart to regress. For this reason, humanity, in all its grandeur and woundedness, must never be replaced or surpassed. We can embrace the technological progress that alleviates suffering and unlocks new possibilities, provided that we do not abandon the very essence of our humanity, namely the capacity for relationship and love. This leads to a crucial question. If an authentic, more than human, exists, where is it to be found? The Christian faith answers that question by pointing to a fulfillment that does not arise from a technological divinization, but through God's grace received in Christ. The authentic more than human, grace and Christian humanism. Paragraph 127. The expression more than human is not an exclusive domain of technological promise. For centuries, the Christian tradition has maintained that human beings are not confined by the boundaries of their own nature. Rather, they are called to self-transcendence, not through an escape from reality or a contempt for their limitations, but through their fulfillment in love. Faith recognizes an openness toward the beyond, which originates as a gift from God. This transformation is a work of the Holy Spirit. As St. Thomas Aquinas taught, this process of elevation and transformation surpasses every capability of created nature, for an infinite disparity separates our finite nature from the life of God. Nevertheless, it remains possible to enter into the heart of that inexhaustible life, even as we journey through the limitations of this world. The one who makes this passage possible can only be the Eternal One, who gives of himself. Indeed, it is God himself who overcomes the infinite disproportionate. In him, the recreation of the human person happens. If anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation. Everything old has passed away. See, everything has become new. Paragraph 128. When we embrace the possibility of transcending ourselves through God's grace, we do not deny our nature, nor do we become less human. On the contrary, as Pope Francis explained, we become fully human when we become more than human, when we let God bring us beyond ourselves in order to attain the fullest of our being. Herein lies the radical departure from Promethean dreams. What saves humanity is not enhanced self-sufficiency, but a relationship that liberates, a communion that transforms. In this light, a technology that merely classifies and optimizes what already exists can, however, unintentionally become an obstacle to change and growth. For an algorithm, an error is a flaw to be corrected. for a person. However, an error can be a catalyst for profound change. A person's future is not calculable, but depends on one's freedom, elevated by the inexhaustible grace of God, and on the relationships cultivated. Two Cities and Two Loves. Paragraph 129. Christian humanism does not reject science or technology, but embraces them with gratitude and realism, and grounds them with a higher vocation. The creative intelligence of humanity is a gift that can alleviate suffering and open up new possibilities, but it must remain ordered toward the common good, justice, the care of the vulnerable, and creation. In this sense, the true alternative is not between enthusiasm and fear, but between two paths of development: a progress that serves individuals and peoples, or a progress that subjects them to the mentality of power. Ultimately, the key question remains, the one posed by St. John Paul II. Does AI make human life on Earth more human in every aspect of that life? Does it make it more worthy of man? If the answer is yes, then we can recognize it's an opportunity to be embraced responsibly on a path of patient shared reconstruction, akin to the rebuilding of Jerusalem narrated in the book of Nehemiah. If, however, power grows while the heart withers and human bonds fray, then we are faced with a new form of Babel, a construction that is grandiose yet fundamentally dehumanizing. Paragraph 130. Questioning this alternative path of progress and how we interpret and live it is ultimately a matter of examining our own hearts, the way we understand and shape relationships, work, and institutions. In practice, reveals our fundamental values. In the end, it all stems from what we hold most dear. This is a love that guides us as to what we truly cherish, both as individuals and as a society, and directs our lives and actions. St. Augustine described human history as a struggle between two loves, which give rise to two ways of inhabiting the world and living together, or two cities, as it were. On the one hand, the love of God and neighbor, on the other, the exclusive love of self. Two loves have built two cities, the earthly city, the love of self, even to the contempt of God, the heavenly city, the love of God, even to the contempt of self. As throughout history, these two loves continue to contend for dominance in our hearts today. The age of AI is no exception. The construction of Babel or the rebuilding of Jerusalem begins within each one of us.
Encyclical letter Magnifica Humanitas of Pope Leo XIV on safeguarding the human person in the time of artificial intelligence.